Oh no, I think there's a lot.
He's at 3% in the polls.
He was at 3% last week. He raised more than Cory Booker.
Yeah, that's fair.
Okay, how much did Cory Booker raise?
$5 million.
$5 million.
Well, ask me another question.
It's what I spend on a night out. Come on.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. The mayor of a small city in Indiana has attracted national media attention and is rising in early Democratic primary polls. An entrepreneur with no political experience already has the 65,000 unique donors required to qualify for the Democratic primary debate stage. While Pete Buttigieg and Andrew Yang's candidacies may sound like long shots, their appeal is nothing new in American politics. Candidates have been making outsider pitches for the presidency for centuries. But is an outsider what Democrats want in 2020? That is what we're going to talk about today, as well as the complicated notion of what it actually means to be an outsider. And here with me to do that are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. How's it going, Nate?
It's going well, Galen.
Fabulous. Senior politics writer Claire Malone. How's it going?
It goes.
That'll do. And Managing Editor Micah Cohen, how are you?
I'm good.
Awesome. Also today, Claire spent the past couple months reporting on the cultural divide amongst white voters in the Democratic Party based on the experience of two suburbs in Cleveland. Very good job, Claire. I'm glad we're going to be able to talk about it and that it's out today.
Thanks.
Anyway, we'll dig into her reporting and talk about some key trends among white voters heading into 2020. But before we get to any of that, we have a question to answer. Good use of polling or bad use of polling? And here's the dilemma. So there are so many candidates running or possibly running in the Democratic primary that pollsters have to make choices about who to include in their polls. And in recent months, the number of candidates included in those polls have ranged from about 6 to 26. And then there are some pollsters who don't pick any number at all and just ask respondents to name their preferred candidates. So this isn't necessarily based off of one outlet's use of polling. Maybe the question is more, what is the best use of polling between 6, 26? How do you decide who to include in your polls, Nate?
I don't do polls, bro.
Okay.
What?
If you want...
I'm so confused about what this site does.
A lot of people think we do polls.
Yeah.
Put that in your polls, Silver, and smoke it.
To clarify, guys, we aggregate polls. We do not poll people.
Okay, we've been down this road before, Nate, but of course we do also judge pollsters. We actually have pollster rankings. Mm-hmm. So if we're grading people on how good of a job they're doing at polling the 2020 Democratic primary, how many people should you include? And how do you make those judgments?
I can't believe Galen has to convince Nate to answer a perfectly legitimate question about polling.
I felt like the intro was very sharp. The Nate, intro to the show is like we get through the intros very fast and like it was really well done.
He needed to put up some roadblocks.
Nate wants to be wooed here.
We were being too efficient. Okay, answer the damn question.
I would include all the damn candidates, Galen, within reason.
Okay, that is not an answer.
It is a great answer. It's the right answer. It's not only an answer, it's
are unreasonable candidates to include, Nate?
I would include Messam. I would include Williamson.
So which ones wouldn't you include?
I include all of them.
But you would go the 26 route. You would include like 26 candidates.
I'd be more conservative about those who have not yet declared. But like, I do not think pollsters should be in the business of deciding who's a real candidate or not. Any case, it's like kind of even borderline, I would include.
I mean, it's interesting because one of the reasons that pollsters give for making what they call editorial judgment decisions about what candidates to include is they're kind of worried about fatiguing the respondent.
Yeah, no,
right?
it is an issue. You know, Pete Buttigieg, Beto O'Rourke, Kamala
Harris. But wait,
Harris,
so talk about that. So
Mike Gravel.
So, okay, you include...
Andrew Yang.
Wait, you include 20 candidates. What are the worries about how including so many candidates affects the result?
I mean, if we literally, like, recited all 26 names, that would take a long time and be a little weird and awkward.
And you might choose names that come earlier in the question.
Yeah, there was some poll where they put Pete Buttigieg first, and as a result, he did better than that poll. But yeah, that's annoying. But I think you have to err on the side of inclusion, especially because now the polls are used to determine eligibility for the debates. And you have to get 1% in three of these basically high-quality polls to get in the debates. By the way, Democratic candidates, I am watching you. If you tell people that you need 65,000 unique donors when you already qualified on the basis of the polls, Julian Castro, John Hickenlooper already called you out. But like, if someone else tries to pull that, I'm going to call them out too. Just warning you, Democrats.
I'm sure they're shaking in their boots.
I'm sure they are.
But one of the complications that comes out of the variation in how many people get polled is trying to compare the results of one poll to the next. So does the range of different candidates included in the polls mean that you can't really compare results across polls?
The answer is yes. It makes it harder to compare with a few of the candidates. So in other words, whether Biden, who has not declared yet, is included in a poll, I would generally not compare a poll with Biden to a poll without Biden. Whether Andrew Yang is included in one poll and not in another, I'd probably be fine comparing those polls.
Yeah. Where if sometimes pollsters will do like, let's put Stacey Abrams in there, or let's put Hillary Clinton in there,
right.
People who are
big names,
you know, big names who may or may not run.
I mean, I kind of am curious about how they determine the order, right? So if you're doing a long list of candidates, do you go with sort of the, well, this person has been in the news in the last week, or which also might skew?
They randomize it. So good polling, they randomize the order that they give the name. So part of what went wrong in that Emerson College poll that mm-hmm. showed a big bump for Buttigieg in Iowa was with like half the sample or something, they had not randomized it. And
yeah.
Buttigieg's name came first for like,
yeah.
I don't know, it was like 150 respondents. And there's all types of research showing that if you don't randomize it, as you hinted at earlier, Claire, people just pick the first one, or, you know, a lot of this is people, they get some spammy call, they're just like hitting buttons.
Option C.
You know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But part of why I do ultimately agree with Nate that the answer here is default towards inclusion. Yes, it's tedious. Is like, in general, I think you want the poll to replicate as much as possible the actual experience of choosing a candidate. And so in this case, there's a lot of candidates. You know, when people go into the voting booth or their caucus, there's going to be a lot of candidates on that list.
Yeah,
you
know? One thing you could probably argue to do is to list the candidates in the same order that they appear on the ballot, which also differs
when polling.
Which also differs from state to state. And sometimes you probably wouldn't know that now.
Yeah.
Obviously,
yeah.
In a national poll, there's no national primary. But that's a legit argument. I mean, some pollsters, I think, try to have different tiers. The more prominent candidates are listed first.
Oh, I didn't know. They do that?
I think it's what Emerson was saying they were doing, right? That we have different tiers, right? And the tiers affect kind of the order of names that you list. Look, this is one case where it's nice just to have an online poll. You know,
it's easier not for the response.
It's not one of the
visual, and
yeah.
You can see.
It's not one of the most important arguments in the online versus live caller debate. But I would think that like this is one instance where it's nice if you have this very long list of names.
Can I ask a question about usefulness? Right, because I think a pretty common question that people ask is, when should I start paying attention to these polls? And do you think that that's different this year? Like up until a certain number of candidates drop out, these polls don't give us that much of a sense of where things are going to be in, let's say, January of 2020.
I would tailor my answer to that depending on the person asking. If it's like a pretty sophisticated news consumer, I would say always pay attention to the polls.
Mm-hmm.
They're not gospel. Expect them to change, you know, but they should be one of many things you're looking at to get a read on U.S. politics and the current state of the race. If you're not at all interested in politics and you want just like a shortcut, December, like after once we get much closer to Iowa.
Yeah, I still remember we have this chart in my office, which I think we used a dry erase marker on a non-dry erase surface, right? So it's still there.
For 2016.
We're pretty sharp over here.
Where it shows like when polls become more meaningful, and there was like an inflection point, I think. After Thanksgiving, which I think we ignored.
Well,
sort of. But that's when after
I tried to convince you not
to read our postmortem on the primary.
Yeah.
Go to 538.com/.
So, Nate, you're not personally putting all that much stock in the polls at this point.
I put more stock in the polls than the other bullshit.
Okay, fair enough.
But, like, it's all relative, right? Right now, the polls are, like, halfway between perfectly predictive and perfectly random. If you're a mature adult who is able to hold multiple thoughts in your head at once, then you should be able to say, okay, Biden and Bernie are doing sort of well in the polls, and of the remaining candidates, Kamala and Beto are doing better than the others. That's meaningful-ish, right? But it doesn't mean that, oh, therefore one of these four people are going to be the nominee, or one of those two people are going to be the nominee, or whatever else. You have to think like in terms of probability and in terms of multiple measures that you're looking at and so on and so forth. I mean, I do think you do actually have this year kind of a consensus of different metrics, right? Where if you look at fundraising, Cory Booker had what I think is a pretty underwhelming fundraising period where he raised only $5 million despite being one of the first candidates to declare, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, now that's consistent with the fact that he was at 2 or 3% in the polls. That's not very impressive. I'm not sure whether or not more stories about what's happening in Cory Booker's campaign. It seems like we've had those stories with a lot of other candidates, but not for him.
But that's actually a perfect example. Booker had these underwhelming numbers according to two metrics, but then it's very, very early and most people haven't endorsed. But Booker actually had a pretty impressive rollout in terms of endorsements from people in his home state. Yeah. So again, it's like you look at this stuff, it's a hodgepodge and you know.
I kind of wonder if we're entering, once Biden gets into the race, if we won't enter into like the next phase of the race or the next phase of polling.
I think that's a good way to look at it.
Where everyone's in, everyone who's big is in, they're getting in all their initial fundraising numbers, they're getting in initial endorsements, and then it's like a relatively, quote-unquote, level playing field for the next few months, and I kind of wonder what polls will be like then.
Jeffrey Skelly, Laura Bronner are working on a series, one part's out, two more parts coming, on early primary polls. So they're looking at polls conducted the year before the primary in two buckets, first half of the year, second half of the year. So look for that on the site. That answers Claire's question in detail and nuance, and it's really good.
So I think we'll say that the best use of polling is include as many candidates as you can to represent the field as it is for the people who actually have to make the decision. Let's talk about political outsiders in the 2020 primary. But before we get to that, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by WeWork. WeWork designs flexible workspaces for businesses of all sizes and industries. WeWork spaces are designed to maximize workplace efficiency, employee effectiveness, team collaboration, and creativity. It's the perfect solution for medium, large, and enterprise businesses who intend to expand into new cities and continents with ease. Looking for an office with a view of Lima, London, Melbourne, Mumbai? WeWork now has over 400 locations in 100 different cities worldwide. Membership plans are completely flexible and workspaces are designed to grow with your team. WeWork's floor mapping technology is used to build out custom private floors for larger teams, perfectly designed to fit your business's continuously evolving needs. WeWork pays special attention to the culture and energy in each of their locations, designed to foster amazing partnerships and collaborations both within teams and across companies. Head to WeWork.com to find a location near you or learn more about WeWork's custom workspace solutions for larger teams. All right, as we mentioned at the top, a couple political outsiders have gained traction in the Democratic primary so far. So we're going to talk about the role that we see those outsiders playing in 2020 in general. Let's begin with who counts as a political outsider. Who in the field would you say gets to claim that title?
I think that for the purposes of this Democratic primary, when there are so many candidates, it's the people who are, I would say, the representatives, the single mayor or mayors, there's Messam in Florida. It's people who aren't in the national news cycle all the time, who aren't national names. Though I would note that one interesting thing that happened in the 2016 election and that you've seen in subsequent elections is Hillary Clinton, I remember her phrasing something like, you know, listen, I'm a woman in I'm not an insider. I'm a woman in politics. I'm the ultimate outsider, right? Mm-hmm. And you see that with some candidates who are perhaps minority candidates or women candidates. They say, listen, I might have a lot of years of experience, but I'm an outsider, which I always thought was very interesting because a lot of these people who were saying that did have the definition of, you know, an insider's resume, mm-hmm. but they had some feeling that voters wanted an outsider. Although perhaps that's different, as we might discuss now.
I think that's a totally valuable point, too. There's insider-outsider in terms of what your resume looks like, but also in terms of your identity. You know, if you're a black politician running for office, you have a very, very good claim to being an outsider.
It's a good way for a politician, I think, to verbalize the phenomenon that we've talked about, which is women candidates and black candidates get covered differently.
Yeah.
So how do you verbalize to the media, to voters, listen, I might have this resume, I might have been in public life for a long time, but people are treating me differently than they would like a white candidate or something, or a male candidate.
In the context of this discussion, I understood outsider to mean people who don't have a lot of experience and do not have a traditional background, whether they've been a governor or a senator or even a representative. Right.
I think that's the default and chief way people mean the term. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just wanted to complicate the discussion.
No, but I think I do think it's a necessary complication because I think if you start going around and saying Kamala Harris is the consummate insider, I think you look a little bit stupid. because of these identity issues.
I mean, I think at the top, we're already establishing that this is a difficult conversation because on the one hand, people run as outsiders who may not be conventional outsiders, right? Like George W. Bush presented himself as this guy from Texas who wasn't particularly familiar with Washington,
right,
who comes from a very establishment family and was the governor of Texas, right? So what exactly it means to be an outsider or run as an outsider gets complicated very quickly. But so let's try to establish in the field that we have who is an outsider.
Yeah, well, look, again, it seems like we have four different definitions now. You threw a new one in there. Because you have experience, right, which is what I was thinking originally. It's number one. Number two is, are you an outsider because of your identity?
Mm-hmm.
Number three is, what does the party establishment think of you? And number four, which you haven't talked about yet, but that's another definition. And number four is, like, are you like a self-styled populist? Are you running against elites or whatever? Right?
By your definitions there, I would say Buttigieg, for instance, is an outsider on a lot of levels. Sexual orientation, level of office, age. But on the other hand, has gotten a lot of plaudits from insiders. I mean, I should point out, he was endorsed in the DNC race pretty early on by some, like, decently influential people in primary states. And I think that sort of inside baseball stuff probably has played very well for him 3 years on.
There's also like a policy dimension to this.
Yeah, how, Sanders.
Yeah, so exactly. How much do you want to upend the system? You know, Sanders, by resume, by identity, is an insider, like as insider as you can get. But in terms of policy and in terms of the, you know, how you're selling yourself, I think you'd call him an outsider, right?
Certainly that's the pitch, right?
Yeah.
I think even now, I don't think the argument that Bernie is an insider, I don't think anyone would find that persuasive.
In part because the establishment, I mean, the Democratic establishment still kind of hates him.
Doesn't love him, let's put it that way.
To complicate this even further, you could say that the president of the United States, who is probably the consummate insider, still considers himself somewhat of an outsider.
And he's not wrong.
Consummate insider in what sense? I don't think he's a consummate
that
insider.
You're the head of a branch of government?
Yeah.
Oh, now.
And you are the establishment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But when he was running, in a lot of ways, he was representative of the traditional and established power structures in America, yet was a very clear political outsider.
And still fashions himself, even as the consummate insider, as an outsider. Which is not new, right? Reagan did that too.
No, and it's not even totally in the
I'm
same
not sure
way
it's
with,
wrong.
Right, exactly. It's not even totally wrong with the same way Sanders is, right? It's like, how much do you want to upend the system? Stylistically, at least, Trump does.
Okay, so we have, Claire, you mentioned Pete Buttigieg. I mentioned Andrew Yang at the top. I think we can say that those are two outsiders. Who else do we want to put in the outsider camp? We mentioned Bernie Sanders. Do we consider him still an outsider?
Let me bring some actual data to this, if I could.
Go for it.
Actually?
Well, actually.
So Morning Consult did a poll where they asked respondents to place all the candidates on a scale from 1 to 10. 1 meaning political insider, 10 being political outsider. First of all, almost all the candidates fell on the insider side of that scale, so 5 or less, right? Every candidate they tested was 6 or below. So it's mostly an insidery field. Biden was the most insidery. He had an average score of 2.8. Second, anybody want to guess?
Gillibrand?
I'm going to go with Bernie Sanders.
That's the answer.
Yes.
Bernie Sanders, rated by respondents as the second most insider, followed by, I'll just go through this really quick, Bernie Sanders at 3.6, followed by Warren, 3.7, Booker, 4.0, Harris and Gillibrand, 4.2, Klobuchar, 4.6, then Castro, then Beto. Anyway, then a couple of the white guys, Delaney's in there, then Gabbard. Andrew Yang on this rates as the most outsidery, which seems fair.
And Pete Buttigieg is a 5.5 and Andrew Yang is a 5.6.
Exactly.
But that list sort of just feels like name recognition to me. Like Sanders and Warren. I mean, Elizabeth Warren's only been in politics for 10 years, but she came in as a national figure. Sanders has been in office for ages. That's fair. But as we were just saying, like, he doesn't have very orthodox ideas. So that list is it kind of is like, where does outsider end and name recognition begin? Like the insider-outsider question versus name recognition.
I mean, maybe there's a fifth dimension, which is just newness, right? Have you been around as a potential candidate for a while? Are you new and fresh, and people like the new and fresh thing? I'm sure Bernie gets up sometimes and he says, you know, how come I'm no longer the new and fresh thing that was fun in 2016?
So do we think that is like a fair categorization of who is an insider and outsider, the list that Micah just gave us?
Buttigieg and Yang and these other candidates who are like aspiring to become president despite not having traditional credentials.
Well, they rank highly on this outsider scale.
Yeah. And then Abrams, if she were to get in, Stacey Abrams would be, I think, certainly in that category, where it's probably like they kind of seem like regular people. Beto, I think, sort of has that, maybe not as authentic a version of it, but Beto is a upper middle brow brand, I think, and not like a boutique hipster brand like Mayor Pete or Yang. So, yeah. I think it is interesting that, you know, of the 5 or 6 or 7 candidates are considered like now leading contenders if you go to betting markets, which are dumb. But if you look at like other metrics, right, you have a couple of people who have much fewer credentials than you'd ordinarily have for a president. And the fact that, you know, Mayor Pete is now getting whatever, 3 or 4% in the polls, which is not that much, but it's as much as Booker or Warren and more generally than like Klobuchar.
I think this morning consult poll captures well one aspect of the insider-outsider dimension, which is the aspect I think Nate was focused on. How much political experience and exposure have you had? But it doesn't capture a bunch of other ones. Like the fact that Bernie rates as the second most insidery is bizarre.
So do Democrats want an outsider candidate in 2020? I mean, if you look back at recent Republican primaries, that outsider mantle was like a very popular one. And of course, the president of the United States currently ran as an outsider. Is that something that works better in a Republican primary, or do Democrats also want that?
I mean, I think the 2016 primary and the strength of Sanders' candidacy proved that Democrats can want an outsider just as much. But I think Trump as president, Trump as the ultimate outsider, the ultimate sort of busting the balls of the political system, has made Democrats want the opposite of that. And I think that, so I think Trump plays a big role in Democrats' conception of who they want their nominee to be.
I mostly agree with that. The one nitpick I would make is I think 2016 showed there's a healthy appetite for an outsider in the Democratic Party, but the insider won in the Democratic primary, the outsider won in the Republican primary in 2016. So I do think it's fair to say even pre-Trump, maybe there was less of an appetite for outsiders in the Democratic Party than in the Republican Party. And then if you look at contemporary polling, an outsider's perspective polls very poorly relative to other characteristics.
But Democrats' version of an outsider this election season, they're all basically elected officials. Like they're not.
Yeah.
And Trump, and I think the Republican primary has tended to attract more of the entrepreneur, the businessman type.
No, I agree with that. What I'm saying, though, is I think maybe there was always less of a appetite for an outsider in the Democratic Party than in the Republican Party.
Yeah.
Always?
Well, maybe like the last 10 years or something.
Well, philosophically, it kind of makes sense if Democrats are the party of large government infrastructure can solve society's problems, whereas Republicans would say government creates problems, and so having somebody from outside of government who can make it run more like some other kind of, you know? I mean doesn't that make sense philosophically?
No, bro.
No? Okay.
Democrats are the party of the everyman, Democrats like to think, and Republicans are the party of the establishment, Democrats like to think. That was a kind of classic mid to late 20th century conception that the parties had, mm-hmm. I guess. So you had Jimmy Carter coming in as like this every man figure, or Bill Clinton doing that.
And Ronald Reagan, though.
And Reagan, yeah.
He was but the then, governor, though.
Governor.
Well, so was Jimmy Carter was the governor.
But I think this gets at, I do think in the 70s, 80s, 90s even, Democrats were a little, the party coalitions were different then, and Democrats were more prone to favor outsiders. And Republicans, I think Republicans, it was less of a movement then, and you had the foreign policy hawks and the social conservatives and it was more coalitional. I think there's something to the fact that nowadays the Democratic Party is more coalitional and the Republican Party is more homogenous. And I just think it's easier for a more homogenous, more movement-y party to rally behind an outsider than like a coalitional party where you're sort of...
They probably can't even agree on who an outsider is.
No, exactly. And so it's like it's more of a horse trading type of thing. I just don't think the Democratic Party lends itself well to that. Nate's given me a...
I don't know, Micah. Because historically, like, the insider party is less populous, right? But you have a more cohesive group of more powerful people. However, it makes up less than half the electorate. By comparison, Democrats have the majority of the electorate, if you're just having two, right, ignoring independents and stuff. And Democrats, there are more Democrats than Republicans. About 38% of the country identifies as Democrat. You know, 32 is Republican. You see numbers like that a lot. So the benefit to Democrats, they have this larger base, right? But it is more like herding cats, where it is more heterogeneous. But the Republicans are not, like, supposed to be the party of the outsider. This is new, right?
No, but it's,
so it may be new, yeah. But it is the case. I mean, if
right.
you look at
I'm saying it's new.
If you look at the specific polling, according to Morning Consult, they just ask Democratic voters bluntly, what do you want in 2020? The number one ranking thing is, has decades of political experience at 66%. The bottom of that list is a political outsider at 29%. And when they ask bluntly, do you want a political insider? 52%, a majority of Democratic voters said, yes, that's what we want.
I think this all also goes back to, let's think about the fundamental philosophies of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party in American political life. Republicans value having less government. They value the idea of rugged individualism. Democrats value government as social safety net, government as problem solver. So it makes a whole lot of sense in some ways that the Republican Party, which values the idea of rugged individualism, wants rugged individuals. And that the Democrats, who value problem solving by government, value people who have experience and decades of experience in problem solving in government.
CNN, by the way, also did a poll where they asked people how much you care about certain traits. Like 87% of Democrats said it was extremely or very important that the candidate has a good chance of beating Trump, has the right experience to be president, 81%, has been consistent on issues over the years, 70%, can bring an outsider's perspective to Washington, was last on that list with 47%.
But is that just a reaction to Trump, right? Is that just Democrats saying, I associate certain characteristics with Trump and therefore I don't want someone who reminds me of Trump, when you put it that way, but then when you actually have a revealed preference, right, meaning how I actually get excited about it, then it seems like these candidates with less experience are more viable than you might have expected.
So if you show someone an appealing outsider who isn't Trump, then all of a sudden that worldview changes.
Yeah, and the fact that you have a lot of energy behind Mayor Pete and behind...
A lot is a relative term there.
Oh, no, I think there's a lot.
He's at 3% in the polls.
He was at 3% last week. He raised more than Cory Booker.
Yeah, that's fair.
Okay, how much did Cory Booker raise?
$5 million.
$5 million.
Well, ask me another question.
It's what I spend on a night out.
I mean, Mayor Pete has an argument for being the least Trump-like candidate. I think Andrew Sullivan had a piece this week and arguing about, like, okay, who is the least Trump-like figure or the most anti-Trump? And he said, you know, because Buttigieg is young and intellectual and kind of humble and modest and gay and all these things.
I always push back on politicians being humble and modest, because almost by definition, if you run for office.
Yeah, where'd the story about him learning, what language was it?
Norwegian, so he could read a book.
That story came from somewhere, okay? Like, you know. I do think Nate is right that if a true outsider candidate caught on, none of this precludes a true outsider candidate catching on. And if one did, then I think you'd see a bunch of polls all of a sudden showing outsider experience valued. But I just don't think that Buttigieg has, like, or any of these people have caught on yet. They're still at, you know.
But so to that point, it's common that during the course of a presidential campaign or a primary, different people have their moments in the sun where they gain traction in the polls. National media pays attention to them. We saw it, you know, with Ben Carson. We saw it with Michelle Bachmann, Herman Cain, among the Democrats. Maybe you could say Howard Dean, right? It's not that uncommon that somebody gets a bunch of traction and then ultimately, like, we don't have President Michelle Bachmann or even nominee Michelle Bachmann. How, like, when should we feel like, you know, this person who came from outside, who's relatively unknown, is here to stay, versus whether or not this is one of those cycles that we go through every presidential campaign when somebody gains traction and then
I think
disappears.
In a race with like 20 people, it's, do you have fundraising numbers? Do you have a real policy platform? Like, people need to be able to say, blank's presidential campaign is about fill in the blank. And it could be about themselves. It could be about, like, I am the perfect foil to the other person. Or it could be about this big issue that they're that's catching on with the voting public.
Also, just does it last for more than a few weeks?
Right.
Like, when we saw in 2012, it was like Rick Perry, Herman Cain, Michelle Bachmann.
Rick Santorum. Everybody had their moment.
Yeah. But it literally was like less than a couple of weeks for all of them, I think. I think part of it is just wait a little bit and see. By the way, all those people shot up like tens of percentage points, not this like puny 3-point.
I think the Buttigieg thing is impressive because he was not getting all this media coverage. You have all these people who are like with these smart takes, like, how come he's getting all this coverage and Elizabeth Warren isn't? Actually, if you look at media coverage, she's gotten like 5 or 6 times as much media attention in like the past month, and probably going back to the start of the primary, probably 20 times as much media attention. So it's like, you know, if someone kind of emerges organically, then I tend to take that fairly seriously. And, you know, there is not a powerful party establishment backing one candidate or another, which means people are more open potentially to, I mean, I don't know, Buttigieg does not have any endorsements yet. Andrew Yang does not have any endorsements yet. Beto, who, again, I don't really think is an outsider, but I guess some people do. He's like the...
I don't think he's an outsider.
He's like the Sam Adams / Sierra Nevada of candidates, if you're a beer drinker. It's a kind of a craft brew, but like a big major label craft brew.
I think that concludes this segment, and we are going to move on and talk about cultural divides amongst white voters and Claire's reporting out of Cleveland. But before we do that, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by 1-800-Flowers. Spring is finally here, and you know what that means. The first tulips of spring from 1-800-Flowers.com are in gorgeous seasonal bloom. These vibrant tulips come in a variety of dazzling colors and are arriving just in time to bring in the new season. Whether you're celebrating a spring birthday, anniversary, or just because, brighten someone's day with beautiful tulips from 1-800-Flowers. And right now, 1-800-Flowers is giving listeners an exclusive 30 for 30 offer. 30 assorted tulips for just $30. With a bright and beautiful mix of orange, yellow, and pink blooms, these assorted tulips are perfect for any upcoming festivities. Tulips from 1-800-Flowers are picked at their peak from premier farms and shipped overnight to ensure freshness. 30 assorted tulips for only $30 is an amazing offer, but you have to hurry because it expires Friday. Just pick your delivery date and 1-800-Flowers will handle the rest. To order 30 stunning assorted tulips for only $30, go to 1-800-Flowers.com, click the radio icon, and enter code POLITICS. Order today and save at 1-800-Flowers.com. Use the code POLITICS. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Lightstream. You know what feels great? Paying off high-interest credit cards, getting a lower rate, and saving money. Refinance your credit card balances and save with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. Get a fixed rate as low as 6.14% APR with AutoPay. You get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000, and there are no fees. You can even get your money as soon as the day you apply. Want to save even more? Listeners get an additional interest rate discount. The only way you can get that discount, though, is to go to lightstream.com/538. That's lightstream.com/538. Subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/538 for more information. All right, white voters are expected to make up 2/3 of eligible voters in 2020, according to Pew, and likely more of the actual electorate. And recent elections show us that it's a group of voters that appears to be growing more politically divided by class. And Claire recently spent some time in Cleveland reporting on exactly that. Her story, A Tale of Two Suburbs, White Democrats' Culture Clash Has Been Long in the Making, is on the website today, and I encourage everyone to go and read it. It's great. But we are also going to spend some time talking about it now. So Claire, if you can kick us off by just giving us, you know, some background, what is The Tale of the Two Suburbs?
I am from one of the suburbs that I write about. I basically went back to the Cleveland area because I wanted to talk a little bit about a topic I think a lot about because I talk to a lot of Ohio voters. I'm in politics. I kind of wonder what's going to happen in 2020. And a lot of people are talking about white working class voters, right? But to me, I think that there's always been a bit of a split between whites, a class split that we don't actually spend a lot of time talking about in a nuanced way. And it's different from just the urban-rural split. It happens in a lot of suburbs. And so in my mind, you know, for the past 2 or 3 years, I always think of these two places, one which I grew up in, Shaker Heights, which is a more classically liberal Democratic place, and another place, Parma, Ohio, which is a more conservative, still Democratic town, but a different kind of place. And in Cleveland, that was always like there's a little shorthand for East Side versus West Side, which I think in the parlance of today's politics, those are pretty good proxies for almost what, like woke Democrats versus union Democrats. And so what I tried to do was go back and talk about class in a way I hope is nuanced, because there have obviously been a lot of stories about Ohio voters. I know that I wanted to talk about the way, you know, it's not just white working class people. A lot of Trump voters were actually pretty well off. But it's about, you know, living in segregated places. It's about your attitudes towards race and things like that. And so I just wanted to write and sort of zero in on two places that were traditionally Democratic, but split. I should mention, I've been rambling, but one of them voted for Trump in 2016. And just kind of like what led to that split. What forms our politics is basically what the piece is about. And our history forms our politics just as much as who's on the ballot in any particular year.
Yeah, I mean, what did you find? What causes that rift between East and West, Parma versus Shaker Heights?
History.
History.
No, really?
Yeah.
It's like,
I mean, one of the reasons why I chose these two places is because they have very particular histories of race and segregation that I think are actually quite important in the way they vote today. So Shaker Heights, where I grew up and which remained Democratic in 2016, was originally sort of one of these garden communities. It was very WASPy. It was very exclusionary. No blacks, no Jews, that kind of thing. And they basically had deeds that wrote in that stuff. And there was some racial violence in Shaker in the 50s. Black people who were moving into Shaker had their houses bombed. And a civic group started. It actually had a lot of white Jewish residents, which I think is a thing I didn't get to get into in the piece, but was very important. And they started giving out home loans to white people to prevent white flight in these integrating neighborhoods. And it basically started this cycle of, I call it proto-wokeness in the piece, that the community that I grew up in, while still having a lot of problems and still a lot of segregation problems, was very conscious of its racial identity. And then you go to the other side of the river in Cleveland, and there's Parma, which is a more working class town that had a huge post-World War II influx of these white Eastern European immigrants for certain neighborhoods in Cleveland, a really homogeneous but tight-knit town that was sued by the federal government in the 1970s for housing discrimination against black people. One of the city councilors of Parma literally went on, you know, at a public meeting that became televised, said, "We don't want Negroes in the city of Parma." That's the direct quote, and it really caught on. And it has developed this reputation within Cleveland. And I kind of wanted to get into, that's the top line, right? Those are the top lines of each city. But I think there's nuance within that. A lot of people love living in Parma because it has this cohesive sense of identity. But then that cohesive sense of identity obviously excludes others. Shaker kind of, I think, pats itself on the back a little bit for its diversity without perhaps like looking a little closer. So I guess, yeah, my long way of saying this is history affects who you vote for.
One thing that always comes up when we talk about the divide amongst white voters is education, whether or not you have a college degree. Was that something that you found across the two different locations? And just Micah and Nate, in our looking at 2016, 2018, and expectations for 2020, do we expect that to continue to be an important trend in how white voters behave?
Yeah, no, I mean, education has clearly emerged in 2016 as one of the most important, if not the most important, along with race, probably dividing lines in American politics. And even race and education are folded together in a lot of complicated ways. You know, I think sometimes people sometimes assume that, like, whichever trend is occurring will continue to occur, when sometimes trends are mean reverting instead. But yeah, I mean, clearly, like, two communities that looked largely identical, or at least somewhat identical before, because from Claire's piece, they're not exactly identical, right? But places that people would have thought of as similar before, when you account for college education levels, all of a sudden begin to look really different and they begin to behave really differently.
Yeah.
Are there dramatic differences in college education?
There are differences in the college education of those two cities. Shaker is much more college educated. I do want to point out here, though, that so the last section of the piece basically poses a lot of open-ended questions, and they're hinged around sort of the emerging alliance in the Democratic Party between white college-educated voters and minorities. And one thing that I talk about is a lot of these white college-educated people actually don't live in communities with minorities, right? They live, the average American white person lives in a place that's like something like 70 or 80% white. And so one of the things that I'm curious about in American life going forward is, well, we currently have this alliance between, let's say, upper-class Americans, white college-educated Americans, and minorities writ large. Well, what happens if, you know, our politics spin on and we become more split by class? Does that alliance, of the current alliance in the Democratic Party, does that stay put? I kept on thinking about this piece I wrote about California where someone said something really interesting to me, which was basically, listen, California, it's just so solidly blue, it's so solidly Democratic, that the real divisions in California politics are over homeowners versus renters. It's over gentrification, basically. And I keep on thinking about that, about, you know, the tension that this political alliance that exists between these two groups of people who don't actually live together, who don't actually interact together, who might have a common foe or a common cause right now. But what if the politics of the country changes in really rapid ways? Say, automation, you know, a rapid shift in our economy. I actually don't know what that looks like. And that was one thing that I kind of wanted to leave people with at the end of the piece is, all right, so we already have this fracturing of people who are traditionally white Democrats, but what comes next?
It sounds like you're suggesting that the fact that these two groups who are currently in an alliance have very different lives could mean that they ultimately go different ways politically. Is that basically what happened between Parma and Shaker? They had an alliance at some point in time politically, but because they don't share common ground, yeah, literally, that, yeah, their political alliance sort of fell apart?
Exactly. Parma and Shaker were both solid Democratic votes for the past few decades. But in 2016, an election where some political science research has showed us that your views on racial politics in America had a really big correlation with how you voted. In other words, voters realized which party fit their racial views. Those two communities diverged. And I think that that's, and this is some work that's done by the political scientists who wrote Identity Crisis, which is a sort of rehashing of the 2016 election. But yeah, I think it was really important that the white people in Shaker, again, a city that still has a lot of problems with inequity and race, developed over a few decades an identity that was like a woke white person identity. Therefore, they were against Donald Trump, right? Versus another community in Parma, which had a much different sense of things. They had a different sense of a different pride in white identity. And I'm not talking about white nationalism. I'm talking about, there's an interesting new book out called White Identity Politics. And it talks about this sort of gradient scale of what's a pride in being white that's not quite white nationalism, but it's almost like you're preferencing your own ethnic group and you're thinking about being white as an ethnic group. And I think that's kind of what's happening in Parma. And I think it's a nuance that we should talk about more because it's not white nationalism. It's a different kind of white identity that certainly has racism tied up in it. But it's rooted in the sense of like, well, we're Eastern European or we're Ukrainian.
Well, that's the thing is like, you know, I don't think anybody would say, and I think your piece did a good job of showing this. I don't think anybody would say, you know, the Polish deli that has a Polish flag up, that's like white nationalism. And yet all that stuff is tied in very closely with views of race, with education. And part of what I think Claire's piece did a really good job of doing is showing how the way we talk about class and the way we talk about these divides is like way too simplistic. And all this stuff is like tied together. And so the fact that it's all tied together, I do think makes it really easy to imagine a world where that alliance between, you know, quote unquote, woke white Democrats and black voters and Hispanic voters breaks down because, like, most of these people aren't living together. They don't quite literally have the same shared interests. And so it's really like more a marriage of happenstance and convenience right now that it's pretty easy to imagine changing.
I mean, you do have this concept that's fallen into disuse called like white ethnic voters.
Yeah.
And what that sometimes means is like kind of, I'll probably butcher the actual definition, but it's like kind of non-WASPy, generally speaking, Democrats. And so, you know, so Polish should be a good example, or Slavic, or Greek, or Russian, right? I'd be curious kind of how those groups have behaved, because they're traditionally quite working class. And there are a lot of these groups in the Midwest and in the Northeast.
This is something that Parma is this. And I actually, in the piece, I describe Parma as its demographic is white ethnic. And coming from Cleveland, and I mean, I'm Irish, but there is this ethnic geography of Cleveland. I have this anecdote in my piece. I came out of, you know, I was in Parma and someone says hi to me. Oh, you're from Cleveland. They find out my last name. I grew up on the east side of the river, which is generally where people associate Italians and Jewish people and black people to live. And the guy said, what's an Irish person like you doing on the east side? So it's this, and it's this, it's not meant in a, it's meant in like a, it's a ribbing thing, but it is people there, people in Cleveland, and I think people in places like Cleveland are extremely aware of the ethnic geography of the place. I mean, you know, I had a woman I talked to who's a black woman who lives in Parma, the pretty white community, saying to me, and this is a pretty common thing to hear in Cleveland, it felt like a foreign country. She grew up on the east side. She went to the west. She ended up living in the west side. She said it felt like a foreign country. And so I just think the awareness of this ethnic geography is kind of interesting, and the way people are proud to live in these places. And it's not an overtly racist thing. It's a, you're proud of where you're from. A lot of these people are from immigrant communities that have, like, you know, you go to the same parish where your parents went and your grandparents went, and that passes down a certain sense of identity. So in the national political discussion, when white voters are grouped into big buckets, I think people don't recognize themselves in those big buckets. They think, wait a second, that doesn't jibe with what my conception of my politics are or my life is.
And I think it's important to point out the book that you mentioned earlier, White Identity Politics by Ashley Jardina. One of the things she establishes is having a pride in a white identity almost, or being white ethnic, doesn't always overlap with having racial resentment.
Yes,
so
correct.
She studies both things separately, and there's a group of people where pride in white identity and racial resentment overlap.
Right.
They are both,
correct,
you know, proud of being white and racist.
Correct.
And there's a group of people that they don't have those qualities, at least in the research that she does, of racial resentment, but still have some kind, place value on their white culture or something like that.
And I think it's an important distinction to draw. This is not to say that, like, and I think this is when we get into, like, kind of hard, nuanced discussions of implicit racism versus explicit racism, because certainly places that are majority white that have histories of excluding people are implicitly racist, but a voter, a white voter from that place, like I said, might not recognize themselves in our conversations that we're starting to have about structural racism. They might say, like, listen, I'm not racist. I'm not teaching my kids to be racist. But I do think that there is a, like, we need to be more cognizant and more nuanced in the way we talk about, well, maybe the structures that you've grown up in are implicitly racist, or, you know, but I do think a lot of white voters chafe at that. And just to bring it back to a more cohesive, like, 2020 discussion, I think the Joe Biden appeal in, like, his whole aura of his campaign is kind of like, he's like kicking it old school, right? Like, he's a little bit, you know, you saw him poking fun at the controversy over him hugging people, touching people in unwanted ways. He was kind of poking fun at it. And I think you saw people on Twitter say, like, he doesn't get it. My reaction to that was like, I think he gets it.
Well, that's the thing. Everybody was like shocked on Twitter. But then you read your piece and it's like, no, yeah, like this is, you know, someone in Claire's piece had a picture of Biden hanging behind the counter.
Yeah, it's a Joe Biden had visited this bakery and he's there. Here's that guy, right? Like, it's a sense that Joe Biden would get it, right? From this kind of white voter's point of view. Getting it, including all of these, like, well, Joe Biden might have the same kind of, like, skepticism that you have towards the wokeness debates, right? But I think that's the feeling, is that, and some of what I think he's doing in the past couple of days following this controversy is kind of signaling to people that, yeah, like, yeah, I kind of think that the woke conversation is silly. I have to nod to it and do a semi-apology.
Yeah, people were like, oh, the semi-apology proved it was a gaffe. I mean, no, it proves that, like Claire said, he's trying to, maybe dog whistle isn't quite the right term, right? But kind of acknowledge it in a way that he's acknowledging, like, oh, it's against kind of the rules. It's not what you're supposed to say, right? But hey, between you and me, this is BS, right? I have to go along with it. And so when the media comes out later, I'll pretend that, like, I didn't mean it and it was a gaffe because I'm Joe Biden. I can do that, right? But, like, between you and me, we kind of know that, like, this is not fair and this is not the kind of Democratic Party that we want. I think that's what Biden was signaling.
No, I think that's right. And I do think, look, I think Claire's right of sort of like, I think a lot of these people don't recognize themselves in national conversations that are happening and would say, hey, I'm not racist. I'm not teaching my kids racism. But I am a little bit like, well, first of all, we should acknowledge we're four white people in this podcast, which makes this a little tricky. But, you know, you have groups of voters who were in the Democratic Party, reliable Democratic voters, until the Democratic Party became explicitly associated with liberal policies on race.
Right.
Right. And then all of a sudden, they're not in the Democratic Party anymore. It's a little bit like, was it an Onion headline that was like, it was like, I'm not sexist. I just hated Hillary Clinton. And something started to rub me the wrong way about Elizabeth Warren, too. You know, there is a little bit of, it's like actions speak louder than words here. And so we're getting towards this. I mean, we're not getting towards it. We sort of are in this position now where you have one party that is liberal on race issues and gender issues, and one party that's quote-unquote conservative on those issues, and yeah, the parties are sorted that way.
Yeah, you know? And I agree with everything you just said, but I also think that we have to be more nuanced in our conversations
totally
about what this means. And I think that the Democratic Party has been a bit we'll see how successful they are in 2020, but I think they are unsuccessful at speaking to these communities that have perhaps voted on racialized lines to say, like, well, what are we doing here? Like, how do you just excise that entire population?
Right.
Maybe you do. Maybe that's a strategy. But I think I also, like, what my only purpose in this piece, or my only goal in some ways, was to, Shaker used to be a conservative city. Shaker had racial violence, right? Shaker is now, like, you know, woke Democrats. Like, a lot of this is, it's nurture, right? It's not nature. It happens from some place. I'm just trying to talk with a little more nuance about how some of the thinking evolves in these places that flip to Trump, that maybe will be Biden ripe for the picking, or will maybe be never voting Democratic again on the national level. But
well, and some of them, you know, regressed back towards Democrats in 2018.
Correct.
So
yes,
it's not like, you know.
Well, that's why I still think it's a pretty open question about right, whether or not they're viable.
By the way, can I just say, this is like obviously very serious subjects, but when I was reading your piece, I kept thinking of, I don't know if people watch Parks and Rec, but Pawnee and Eagleton.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Well, we've arrived at Parks and Rec, so.
So we should stop.
People, read the piece. It's very, very good.
It's
deeply
really
reported.
Good.
Just go read the piece, 538.com.
All right, and I think that's where we're going to leave it. So thank you, Nate.
Thank you.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
Congratulations again. And thank you, Micah.
Thanks.
And as you may have heard, we are heading to Texas in early May. Our live show in Austin is already sold out, so sorry if you couldn't get tickets for that. But tickets for our Houston show on May 8th are now on sale. So I don't know if you're in Austin and you didn't manage to grab a ticket, maybe you can head over to Houston. Or if you're in Houston, go to 538.com/live for details and to get tickets. I think it's going to be fun. We're going to talk about Texas.
I'm seeing how long a drive it is from Austin.
It's 3 hours. I looked at
it. 2.5 hours.
Oh, really?
That's not bad.
I think we're going to do that drive. Who at this table has a license
or
and can drive us from Austin to Houston?
I can drive, and I have done that drive before.
I can drive, too. Claire, can you drive?
Not to brag, but I'm an excellent driver.
First Nate, can
all,
you drive?
That's not subject for the podcast, guys.
Nate can't drive.
All right. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.